said, well, could you come and speak and do three lessons on the bees? Of course, I'm a beekeeper back home in New Zealand. We run about 850 beehives. That has enabled us, it's been a real blessing because it's enabled us to be able to come over here to the US during what is our winter months. So we winter our beehives down, get on the plane, come over here, and we get to enjoy another summer. People say, oh, what? Oh, you sacrifice so much to come over here. And I say, oh, you have no idea. Freezing cold at home, and we get another summer over here. So it's really no sacrifice at all. It's a real blessing and a privilege to be here. So you think, well, all right, so how are we going to do this? You know, talk about the bees, and someone was asking me, well, you know, you can have enough information. I'm like, have enough information. That will not be the issue. The issue will be how do you whittle it all down? You know, and there's so much that gets left out. And so we have the Bible and the bees. Not to be confused with the other subject, but what we're going to do is, obviously, we don't just want to have a talk about some little insects and come away thinking, well, I learned something about the bees. We want to obviously make the spiritual connection and see if there's any truths, anything that we can learn along the way. Of course, in Genesis chapter 1 and 2, we have the record of the creation, God creating everything, and day 3, the plants are made. On day 4 or 5, there's a little bit of conjecture there, but the insects, but it's all in that first creation week, and God's looking at all, saying that it's good, it's good. And so he made the bees and along with everything else. And we'd never want to. I don't sort of have a favorite Bible verse because I think, well, you know, I like all of the Bible verses that are in the Bible, and I wouldn't want to just single out one of God's creations for special attention above the others, but. But nonetheless, we're going to zero in on the bees today, and we're going to have a look at them. And, you know, I sort of think, I do have thought often, though, that the bees are probably on the ark with Noah and probably in a corner somewhere, making it through. I kind of wish that Noah had swatted at least one of the mosquitoes, though. That would have been good. You know, it didn't have to get both of them. Just one would have done the job. But you know, mosquitoes, part of God's creation, have a role to play. So the bees, we want to put the spotlight on them. And, you know, I think if I put up on here, you see that in Romans 1 and verse 20, it's a very powerful verse when you look at it, because it talks about that God has created everything, and through the creation we can see the eternal power of God. We can see Him through what has been made, and understand, see His the invisible aspects of God. So we can't see God with our eyes, but we can see what He's made. We can see what He's done in this world, and so. So that's what we're trying to see. And I think that when we look at the bees, and we will see, we definitely will see God and see His handiwork in there. And that's one thing we're trying to see. We also notice that there in Psalm 104 and verse 24, that God has, He has in wisdom made everything. The next verse down up there, Proverbs 3 and verse 19, through wisdom, God has founded the earth. So God put some thought into what He was doing when He created everything, and you could see the ingenuity, if you like, the design, the work that God has done in the creation, and that has something to say about Him and who He is. And like I say, we're zeroing in on just one of God's creatures here. But we think about ourselves. Psalm 139 verse 14 says, I've been fearfully and wonderfully made. But it, not just us. Yeah, that verse talks about as an individual, as a human being, being fearfully and wonderfully made. But there are many creatures on this planet that have been wonderfully made and really well designed. That's fascinating. It's intriguing to look at. The heavens declare the glory of God. You can look to the heavens and be amazed, but the heavens are not the only thing that declare the glory of God. There's other things as well that declare his glory. In the past, and as you read through the scriptures, you'll find that there are times when God points people, directs people to the animal world or to the insect world. You know, and if you're lazy, if you're a someone who's a bit slothful, you know, we're told, go look at the ant. Go and observe the ant in Proverbs 6 and observe her ways. Look and see what you can learn from what has been made. We think about Matthew 6, verse 25 and following. Jesus himself said, look at the birds of the air, you know, consider the birds of the air and how God looks after them and how God takes care of them and how God has made them, and then understand that you are of much more value than the birds. And so there's a lot that we can learn. There's passages in the Bible like, you know, the leopard can't change its spots. And there's a point to be made there, and many, many others. I think perhaps one of the most intriguing ones there at the end of the list is Balaam's donkey. That's a real interesting account. You know, Balaam learns a lesson from a donkey that talks. And of course, it's a miraculous situation there, but it's interesting nonetheless. Now, the quote at the very bottom there is from Albert Einstein. And this quote is that if the bees disappear from the surface of the earth, man would have no more than 4 years to live. Why would he make such a statement? Well, it's because bees are so important, so critical to the way that this world operates. And so perhaps the most underrated aspect of the work that bees do is the pollination. So basically you'll have all sorts of things being done in this world, all sorts of things being done in a congregation like this, where people don't really give a lot of attention to it. You know, there's a lot of things that get done behind the scenes. And, you know, when we come into Jacksonville, and 2 years ago we stayed at the Hampton Inn, and then we come in 2 days ago, someone from the congregation here or people have, I don't know if the congregation knows this, but there's a basket that's in there. Someone's responsible for putting this basket, and it's not just like a basket with a couple of things in it. I mean, you got the works in there. There's candy, there's chocolate, there's Advil, there's pen and paper, there are little peanut. There's so much stuff. We could spend the whole class talking about what's in that basket. And I appreciate whoever's responsible for that. Look, it's appreciated. And I don't know if this is something that you guys, you know, it's the big work of the congregation here and everyone knows about the basket at Hampton Inn, or maybe only a few people know about it, or maybe it's just one or two people that do this. All I'm saying is there are a lot of good things that go on that sometimes people don't even give a lot of attention to. And all I'm saying is I appreciate the basket and nibbling on the goodies that are in there, and it's like Christmas time for the kids, so it's fantastic. But someone does that work. And I think a lot of people, they see a bee and the first thing they think is, you know, I want to kill that thing, you know, I want to get rid of that bee, because there's something that everybody knows about the bee, you know, is what the element of pain that can be associated with it. And so, but the bees do this most important work of pollinating. They it's estimated that 1/3 of what ends up on your plate, what you eat, has been pollinated by the bees. In fact, 75% of fruits, vegetables, seeds, and nuts have been pollinated by bees. You, in this country, in California, you have a multi-million dollar almond industry that provides the majority of almonds for the globe, for the planet. And it's close to 1 million beehives are brought in when the almond trees are flowering to pollinate them. And it was interesting, I sat next to a gentleman on a plane flying out to LA to go back to New Zealand, and he worked on the machinery that took the husk off the almonds. You know, you can get the almonds, they don't have the sort of woody bit on, it's just white. Well, he worked on machines, but he knew all the facts and figures. I did this last time when I was here. I kept standing on this thing here, so if I do that, just if I fall over, well, then that'll be hilarious, but I'll keep looking around and doing this the whole time, I guarantee you. Anyway, he was saying that, he had it worked out that if the bees didn't pollinate the almonds, they know the facts and figures of what the yield will be, and it will be way, way down. It'll be next to nothing. And so these bees do a fantastic job pollinating. Anyone had coffee this morning? Well, you want to be thankful, these coffee lovers here. You never thought of the bee, probably, when you were drinking your coffee and enjoying that, but if it wasn't for the bee, because the bee pollinates the coffee plant, so we ought to be thankful for the bee. Right, what are some design aspects of the bees? Well, you have in nature these, what are they called, symbiotic relationships that exist. And so you can't have the bees without the flowers, because the bees need the flowers, and the flowers need the bees. In fact, there are some plants that cannot exist without the bees. For example, orchids and many others. So here's the question. We can learn a valuable lesson from the bees when we think about creation. We have people who try to read in to the Genesis 1 creation account millions and billions of years. And so if you've heard of the day-age theory, where they suggest that the days were not literal 24-hour days, but were indeed long geological ages. And then you have what's called the gap theory. And this places the millions and billions of years in between the days. So there was the day and then a gap. That was where you fit the millions and billions of years in. Well, there's a serious problem with this, because the bees can't survive without the plants, and the plants can't survive without the bees. So if the plants are created on day 3, and then it's a long millions and billions of years, how do those plants get pollinated? So, because there's no bees, they're coming later, you see. So really, away with the day-age theory, away with the gap theory, let's just take the Bible as it is written, and that makes perfect sense and fits with what we know. Now, it's really interesting that, as you know, you can get, if you get a balloon and you've got a woolen jersey on, or you can rub it up against yourself and have you ever done that? Put it on your hair. Some of you would be challenged with doing this, I can see. But anyway, as you can see, I did it this morning and my hair still stuck up. But so the bees, as they fly through the air, they develop a positive charge. And I thought this will be the corniest point that I would make all day. And it's be positive, you know, but I won't go too far into that. But they develop a positive charge as they fly through the air, right? So then it's interesting that the flowers have a negative charge. So the bees fly along and they come in to get the nectar, right? And as they come in, actually, I'll go forward to the next slide. You'll see the pollen just basically, they don't go around having to pick up each little bit of pollen. It basically just flies onto the hairs of the bee. And then the bee will groom all of that off with its legs. It'll groom all of that pollen off. And then it'll have a bit of nectar that it will moisten the pollen with. And it will scrape it down to what they call the pollen basket, which is not really a basket. It's just there's a little angle in the hind leg. And it's got some little hairs around it that hold that pollen in. And you can just kind of pack it on there. And that's why you see the bees flying along with the pollen. But it's pretty fascinating how all of this works. And then, interestingly enough, I'm trying to go back one. So then what's interesting is that once a bee has visited the flower, the flower loses a bit of charge, bit of voltage. And so when there's other bees that are flying along and they come up to a flower, I mean, there's a lot of bees out there. In a hive, there might be up 60, 70, 80,000 bees, and 50% of them out foraging. There's probably other beehives around. So, I mean, it's going to be pretty frustrating. You know, you come to a flower and, oh, someone else has been there. And then you come to, oh, someone else has been there. But God's designed it so that as the bees fly along, they can pick up on this loss of voltage, if you like, from the flowers and bypass those flowers and go on to the next. And I had this quote here. I looked up this information and I've got this quote here, which I thought that, so they did some experiments on this in Bristol in the UK, Bristol University in the UK, the University of Bristol, and they made these flowers with that gave off a charge, and they went through all of this and they were amazed. They said, that's how we know it was the electric field that they were learning. So they were learning that when there was a drop in the voltage, they would go to the next one, and they were like, the bees were learning that. And then here's the amazing quote. Animals are just constantly surprising us to how good their senses are. More and more we're starting to see that nature's senses are almost as good as they could possibly be. You know, and the reason why it's so amazing is because it all happened by accident and by chance, and so it's just as good as it could be. Well, it's as good as it could be because God designed it to be that way. And so you have these symbiotic relationships that exist in nature, and they're very difficult to explain from an evolutionary standpoint because they're so finely balanced as well. And you can't have one without the other. You can't have, so the bees are evolving, but you've got the plants evolving at exactly the same time, and it all has to be just right. You know, how do you get that to work? Now, I started chasing some rabbits when I was looking at this, and I thought, okay, these symbiotic relationships, and it's amazing how finely tuned the universe is. And there are a range of things that have to be just right. For example, and I remember this one example, I give it to you, but there's many, many others. So you have this the ratio of electrons to protons. And I'm no brainiac, but I'm not trying to. I've read this, and now I'm giving it to you. I didn't sort of study it and make it up myself, but the ratio of electrons to protons, the ratio has to be 1 to 10. To the power of 37. And when it sort of gets to those numbers, we're kind of, well, what does that mean? Well, it means 1 part to 10 followed by 37 zeros. And the illustration to bring it home to us is that you could get a nickels and place them all over North America, all over, to the moon, 239,000 miles high, and then paint one red. And that gives you an idea of what 1 part to 10 to the power of 37 is. Now, what's amazing is that if that's not, and you would think, oh, wow, well, there's going to be a huge, wide, you know, variation in there, wiggle room. But there's not. It has to be accurate. One of the balances that needed to be, one of the relationships that needed to be right was 1 in 10 to the power of 120. And they said if it was 10 to the power of 117, it's not going to work. So you've got all of these ratios and relationships and things that need to be absolute. What are the chances? I mean, what are the chances of just getting one of these right, let alone multiple symbiotic relationships, things that need to be in order for the other to be, in order for this world to exist, and in order for life to, it is so, I mean, it is in the realm of impossibility. There is a creator God, who has made, and we can see his handiwork when we begin to look at these things. The mathematics of it all tell a wonderful story. The flowers have been designed to attract the bees. The smell, the color, the patterns have been designed to attract the bees. Now, I think we should. There's an example. So here's a frame, a honey frame, right? And if you look at the top right, top left-hand corners, that's honey that has been capped or sealed with wax. Then you've got this kind of a band that runs around like a rainbow. That's where the pollen goes. And the pollen goes through a bit of a process when it comes in, and then it's called bee bread. And then you've got the sort of tan area there is the brood. That's the young worker bees that are being raised. So that's sort of what the bees do with it. But so what you have then is you have this work of service that's being done by the bees, the enormity of the task that's before them, and yet they get out there and they hustle up and they do this work. We often don't come to realize, sometimes even in the church and a congregation, the amount of work that someone does until they're gone or until they stop doing it. And then we look around and we who was doing all of that cleaning or who was getting this prepared? Because now it's not being done, and maybe we hadn't really given a lot of thought to that in the past. But there's great lessons in the Bible about serving others. Jesus took a towel and washed the feet in John chapter 13. We are encouraged to be serving one another, and the attitude is given to us too in Colossians 3 verse 23, that whatever we do, we ought to do our work heartily for the Lord rather than men. And so when we're serving, I know the people who put the basket in the room didn't do that so they could be, well, I'm doing this so that someone will praise me. They're doing it because it's a nice thing. It's a good thing to do. Regardless of whether or not someone says anything about it, it's still a good thing to do. And so we are to serve one another tirelessly, and, you know, make it, that's what Christianity is about. It sort of changes things around for people. You know, the way to be great is to be sort of humble and small. The way to greatness is not, and to arrive at greatness is not when you're being served, it's when you serve. And so I think that's what, and there's a lot of unsung heroes, no doubt, in this congregation and in many congregations around the world. We ought to appreciate those who labour amongst us. We ought to appreciate our leaders. We ought to be thankful for the elders and for the deacons and for everyone who has a part to play. Right, job allocation. So it's a collective effort a beehive is where the bees live. It's the house, okay? And then you've got the colony, which is the queen and the workers and the drones. And you have three main castes of bee. The one to the left is the worker, smaller female bee. The one in the middle is the queen. starts out the same as a female bee, fertilized egg, but because of the diet that it's fed and the cell that it grows in, it becomes a queen. And then the one to the right is a drone, male bee. The drone is an unfertilized egg, and the queen, as she comes along, she can detect the size of the comb. So the workers have a smaller size, and so she'll lay a fertilized egg in there. When she comes to the drone comb or a drone cell, she'll lay an unfertilized egg that'll become a drone. And the drone will be genetically exactly the same as the queen. So when you're breeding queens, when you get into queen breeding, you're really, you're using drones, but it's actually you're kind of breeding a queen's genetics to another queen's genetics. Because obviously the drones are involved, but they're a replica of the queen. There are numerous jobs to be done. There are attendant bees who look after the queen. The queen doesn't feed herself or hydrate herself or clean herself. That's all done by attendant bees. They take care of the queen. You have nurse bees, and the nurse bees will be looking after the brood, the baby bees. They'll be feeding them nectar and pollen and royal jelly will get fed to them, and they have that job to do. You have builder bees who are building the comb. You have undertaker bees who are getting rid of the dead bodies, and they, if they can't remove them, they embalm them in propolis. You have scout bees who go out. They'll scout out for forage, for food, for nectar source, or pollen source, or water. Then you'll end up with the foragers going out, and they'll go out looking. They're looking for the food once the scout bees have come back. So there's all sorts of jobs that are going. You've got guard bees who wait at the entrance of the hive, and if an intruder should come in, they're going to take care of business and scare them off, try and remove them. So there's all of these jobs that are to be done, and it's all for the betterment of the whole group, the whole hive, the whole colony. Now, bees don't live long. In the heart of the season, in the honey flow, the worker bee is only living about 4 to 6 weeks maximum. They literally work themselves to death. Queens can live for maybe upwards of 5 years, but generally they're starting to run out of go by that time. I mean, we're really replacing our queens, every year we're trying to replace our queens. And there's a bit of a way in which we go about doing that, but we won't get into that at this point. But the point is, all of these jobs that have to be done within the colony and within the hive, how do bees learn to do that? How do you learn? I mean, we are born and we've got to learn to, we want food and everything, and then we grow and we've got to learn to walk and crawl and then talk, and then we don't just sort of come out because mum and dad were, PhDs in mathematics. It doesn't mean that we know mathematics. We've got to learn it. And so we observe and we learn and we're taught, and eventually we get to some point in time where now we've learned enough to be, we're going to be useful and we're able to be employed and put to work. But how do these insects, how do the bees learn to do all of the jobs and the work they need to do? Well, it's been pre-programmed into them by God. It's been designed. How do you inherit an instinct? Now, I was quite curious about this, so I looked up to see what Richard Dawkins would have to say about this. So, and he's quite a prominent evolutionist. And so they have this idea, this theory, it's called the Baldwin effect. And you sit there listening to it and it's like, this guy's meant to be really smart. he's meant to be really intelligent. And he's there talking about how the really smart bees work stuff out quicker, and then somehow they're able to pass on their smartness to, well, it wasn't specifically bees, but other insects who in turn are fast learners, and then, and then blah, 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 the end. It was like, how do you how do you inherit an instinct? Well, you don't. It's basically been pre-programmed by God. It's been there at the beginning when he made them. And that's why a bee will hatch out, it will groom itself off, and it will go straight to work. Not because it's learned anything, but because of the way that God made it to behave. All of these jobs, the bees don't fuss and fight with each other. They get on with the job, and at various stages of their life, they will shift and do other jobs. Sometimes there is a problem in a colony, in the beehive, and so then bees will adjust the work that they're doing to come over here and take care of an issue over here. And look, it's the same. There are the passages in the Bible which talk about the church being a body, you know, and everyone's important in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Everyone has a part to play. Romans 12 is the same. You know, we're all part of one body, many members, but one body. But do you know the real goal, I think, of the leadership here, the elders, and the real goal for everyone here at the Jacksonville congregation is to try and achieve what Paul talks about in Ephesians 4 and verse 16, where it talks about having the proper working of each individual part. And when you have the proper working of each individual part, it causes growth for the whole. And I think that's really the goal that we have, or ought to have, I think, for each congregation, is to know the people who are worshiping with us, to know the people who are members of this congregation, part of the spiritual family here, and to try and find a place, a work for every person, so that everyone is doing what they can do. And obviously, the jobs are going to be different. Obviously, people are going to have a different role to play, but it all works together for the building up of ourselves. When the queen begins to, when she begins to slow down her egg-laying rate, when she's not functioning as, prolifically as she needs to, she needs to be replaced, you know, otherwise the colony is going to suffer. When winds get up, real strong winds get up, or rain comes quickly, although the bees are normally onto that and get home, you know, they're able to sense that, but sometimes they can get caught out, you know, they can be flying along and you can have a lot of the foraging bees don't make it back. Well, then there has to be adjustments made. But it actually causes the colony to have to take a step back. And I think that's the case in the church, you know, that the church will function and the church will get by in spite of you. But really what we want is the church to get by and to grow and mature because of you, you know, because of us, that we have a part to play in it, whatever that part may be. And of course, I think one of the main areas where we can all function and do well is in the area of evangelism. I think sometimes we have this idea that, you know, evangelism is maybe one person's job, or a few people who are good at that, they do that job, but yet God is encouraging us, and I think I spoke on this last time I was here, was that, you know, we all have to have a part to play in that. And really, God's strategy for evangelism, God's strategy for reaching out, is for each individual to let their light shine in such a way before men that they see your good works and yet God gets the glory. That's what Jesus said in Matthew 5 and verse 16. So the idea of going, the youth and Alan have gone on, they're going to be doing some door knocking, and that's a specific, you know, targeted evangelistic event, organized, planned. They'll go out there, they'll execute that, they'll come back. That's just a part of it. It does not replace the individual responsibilities that we have to let our light shine wherever we are. So the idea is that we come here collectively as a congregation, we meet together, we get built up, we learn information, we learn how we can reach out, and then as we go to the various walks of life, I don't know what the membership, I was looking for the, Okay, so you have probably, you got maybe a couple of hundred people that were here, at least on the board there. So now how many people do those 200 people touch in a week? You know, would it, well, if we said 10, it would probably be quite conservative. But let's say from the 200 people there, there's 10 people that each person comes into contact with through a week. That's 2,000 people, see? So the idea is that what we want to do is to try and be that positive influence wherever we're at, you know? Try to make a difference in people's lives, try to reach out with the gospel. We can do it. That's God's plan. And then if it was just a percentage of those people, even if just one a year was brought to Christ, before you know it, you know, there's 400. And then there's 400 people touching 10 people every week. So then there is this exponential growth that can happen. What time am I finishing here? I got 5 minutes, okay. So I don't want to start another point at this because I want to, because I'm doing the sermon and also the sermon tonight. And so I've kind of got this information. I won't go too far ahead. But let me stop. And if there are any questions that you have that I might be able to answer, if not, I can keep going. I've got another point I can make, but I thought I'll just open it up for the 5 minutes that we have. But if you've got any questions about what we've covered so far,
are there any jealousy in a beehive like that, or do you even know if they were?
Each hive, the queen has like 15 glands, and she will secrete basically a chemical concoction, which we call pheromones. And these pheromones are released by a queen and spread throughout a colony. And it influences the behavior of the bees. And they're kind of united in a way through scent to be united to that queen. And each queen has an individual, unique scent. So that's kind of the glue that holds everything together. I'll make a point about that later on with reference to the unity of the church and how we're connected through the blood of Christ. So what you would do then is you'll have the queen has the scent, it's uniting the hive. It also helps to keep the worker bees, which are females, sterile so that they're not going to be able to, let their ovaries grow and cause a problem for the queen. So she's going to keep everything under control. As she gets older and those pheromones begin to weaken, then the bees are alerted to the fact that we need to remove that queen, and they'll do what's called supersedure. They will produce another queen. So jealousy may not be the right word, But they can certainly recognize, you know, they might recognize that, hey, this is not my queen, and that sort of keeps them together. But I mean, they will fight. I mean, if you start to come in and try and rob another beehive, will try to rob a weaker beehive. They're going to fight, you know, to protect themselves. So that's the sort of the role of the guard bees, and then all the bees are coming out to protect. Mm. Sir. Sure, that's happening now in the year 2000, the varroa mite, varroa destructor, used to be called varroa jacobsoni, was found in New Zealand, and it spread throughout the two main islands now. So I think that you kind of, what you're experiencing over here with the colony collapse disorder, it's what they call it, but it's probably a combination of what they call, you know, just the perfect storm. You've got all sorts of things that are happening. Varroa is the worst problem globally for bees. And it's not just that it's like this parasite that's on a bee, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, probably get to that maybe tonight. But, you know, the varroa mite as a parasite is quite large. I mean, you think of parasite maybe small, but I mean, if you had a sort of a plate, dinner plate size parasite living off you, that's going to be quite, you know, that's not going to be good for your health. Furthermore, that's not the worst of it. They live off the hemolymph, the blood, so they inject sort of into the bee, and it introduces all sorts of viruses and problems, so it weakens the health of the hive. So there's varroa is a major issue. Then we have the way we like to do our farming, you know, and we want to get the plough in and we want to plough up a field. You just basically kill 100% of the habitat, and then we plant the corn or whatever it is, the grains, and we spray. And of course, the spray is the pesticides, the neonicotinoids that are affecting the bee's central nervous system. That's got a part to play in it. The lack of forage, you know. In New Zealand, you know, we put a lot of our hives on the dairy farms before we take them up to the Manuka country, because up in the Manuka country, it's so, in the hills, it's so cold and harsh that you sort of got to move them out. But the dairy farmers, now, you know, they don't leave anything on their farms. You know, it's just like every weed, every bit of everything is gone, you know, so that they can make the most out of the per acre and cow ratio on the farm. And of course that affects the bees as well, the lack of forage. So last year, which is part of the reason I have to go back early this year, when I got back from PTP, we lost about 200 hives. And it was, you know, I don't know if it was really avoidable if I was there, but we're facing some real, you know, we are facing some problems in New Zealand just keeping the bees going, keeping them alive. And there's a lot of work being done because people recognise the, you know, people recognise the benefits. One lecturer over here, and they'll be done, he was saying that, you know, the best thing that we could do is get all of the housewives in the United States, because that's where he was speaking, to refuse to buy, you know, grain-fed products. So if it's the milk, you know, the meat, it's grass-fed. And if it's any products to do with dairy, all grass-fed, because then you get the pastures coming back, you know. And so he said that would make a huge difference, because it would eventually, if everyone did that, all of those farmers who want the money would be saying, okay, we've got to change. We've got to go back to having pasture and raising grass-fed cattle and grass-fed dairy, and then that would help the bees. But is that going to happen anytime soon? Well, we could start an experiment with this congregation. The problem is that it's a bit more expensive to start to do that, you know. Yeah, would we be willing to make the sacrifice? Hey, we're done for now, and thank you for your time, and we'll be back at it in a few moments with the lesson. Soon. Thank you.